Tonight's topic has an odd title, The Measure of Love. In other words, how much do we love? How much love do we bring into the world? And this topic came out of reflections around the life of Dr. M.L. King, whose day we celebrate. As you may know, toward the end of his life, he had been working for years for racial justice, and he started to work in early 1968 on something called the Poor People's Campaign, where he's looking at the way that race and poverty are kind of tangled up in this country, and looking at issues of economic inequity. And in February in Memphis, the sanitation workers had gone on strike, and it was they were facing all kinds of discrimination and horrible conditions. A couple men had been tragically killed in a garbage compactor, and so they were on strike, and he was going there to support this strike. So he was, and he knew at this point in his life that there were threats on his life. There were going to be threats on his life in Memphis. And essentially, he was making the decision, even if it was going to cost him his life, he was going to support these sanitation workers. On April 3rd in Memphis, he arrived there a couple days earlier, and on April 3rd, he gave a speech in the evening. The speech is sometimes called the Promised Land Speech. And toward the end of it, he acknowledged the threats to his life. He said, longevity is a great thing, but I'm not thinking about that right now. Then he used the metaphor of going up onto the mountain, the biblical metaphor of going up on the mountain and seeing the promised land. He might not get there, but he knew that his people would get there. And the next morning, he was shot on his balcony, shot and killed on the balcony of his hotel. So Dr. King would have known this verse from the Bible. This verse from the Gospel of John. Jesus said, "This is my commandment, that you love one another as I have loved you. Greater love has no man than this, that a man lay down his life for his friends." And so that statement from Christianity, of course, sets a very high bar for, how much are we supposed to love, laying down your life for your friends. And we, not surprisingly, we get similar high bars in Buddhism. I'll just read a section from one of the versions of the Bodhisattva vow. "Enthused by wisdom and compassion, today in the Buddha's presence, I generate the mind for full awakening for the benefit of all sentient beings. As long as space remains, as long as sentient beings remain, until then, may I too remain and dispel the miseries of the world." And so this broad vision of the Bodhisattva vision, that I'm going to put off entering nirvana until I can save every being. I don't know what's going on above me, but I don't know if you can hear it. Someone's doing acrobatics or something. Anyway. And it's, it's striking because modern neurobiology has pointed out how much we're wired for love and connection. Not only we humans, but really all mammals, there's a strong, you might call it a warm, fuzzy trend that runs through all mammalian behavior. And of course, for us humans, the warm, fuzzy side of love, that is more the feel-good side of love. That's not obviously not the whole of love, and not often the most difficult parts of love. And so it's an interesting question. How much do we love? To what extent are we loving people? And it's interesting to just think of the thought experiment. Suppose some, I don't know, polling organization, you know, interviewed every person in my life, you know, interviewed all my families, my colleagues, my coworkers, and asked them all about me. How loving is Mike? You know? And if we asked everyone in your life, what would people say? You know? And just notice what comes up with that question. You know, no judgment. Just notice what comes up. You know, or even just to reflect on the question, to what extent, am I a loving person? What am I willing to risk for love? You know, it's a standard in many ways. You know, it's almost cliche to say, but when people are dying, when they're at the end of life, what they most reflect on is the love in their life. No one at that point really cares about career achievements or anything like that. What's most important is the kinds of love that they shared. And the people who are most fulfilled in those last few days of their life are the ones that just had tremendous amounts of love in their life. And there are people who still love them and they have warm memories of love. The deepest regrets that people have in their last few days of life tend to be around opportunities for love that they didn't pursue. You know, and so it's an interesting question right now in your life. Is there an opportunity for love that you're not pursuing? Maybe there is, maybe there isn't, you know. And the question, how loving are we? It's, you know, of course, there's many different kinds of love, you know, and probably in some sense, the purest to think about is just compassion. Compassion toward, say, acquaintances or strangers, people we don't even know that well. How loving are we to them? You know, with friendships, it gets a little trickier. With familial members, it gets a lot trickier. And probably the trickiest of all to evaluate is how loving are we in a romantic relationship, you know, because then it's so much about our projections. Am I loving the person actually there? Am I loving my fantasies about that person? You know, it's much trickier there. But one standard that I really like, certainly in romantic relationships, but really can be applied to any love relationship. Let's see if I can remember these. What David Riccio called the 5 A's of relationship: attention, affection, appreciation, allowing. I've forgotten one. Attention. Yeah. Anyway. But allowing in particular, do we allow people to be who they are? Do we allow the people closest to us to be who we are? Do we allow people in the world to be who we are? Do we allow ourselves to be who we are? A big part of the question of how loving I am, of course, comes down to self-love. You know, and again, it's another one of these cliches that I can't really love anyone else if I can't love myself. Approval, the other A. Thank you. Attention, acceptance. I don't think it's approval, though. No, attention, acceptance. Affection. Yeah, I think attention, acceptance, affection, appreciation, and allowing. Those I think are they. Anyway. Self-love. There's all kinds of odd stories we have about self-love. And you know, if I love myself, then I'll become undisciplined, or I'll become self-indulgent or something like that. You know, whereas in fact, self-discipline is one of the most robust expressions of self-love. You know, a person who is highly self-disciplined is a person who's taking a tremendous effort to take care of themselves in important ways. And it's interesting, from the point of view of Buddhism, self-love has a very different quality than from the point of view of Christianity. You know, some versions of Christianity, you know, you're supposed to serve other people and ignore yourself, this sort of thing. And Buddhism just has this message that, you know, the difference between self and other is ultimately an illusion, you know? And so if I'm being mean and abusive to somebody else, well, that's not good. But if I'm being mean and abusive to myself, that's just as bad as being mean and abusive to somebody else, you know? Like, and so it's just something to think about, you know? What's the standard of behavior with which you treat the people you care about in your lives? And what's the standard of behavior that you treat yourself with, you know? And how does love look there? Now, at the beginning, I talked about these high standards of love, and for those who were raised with a Christian or Jewish background, sometimes those high standards can land as shoulds. You know, you should be more loving. You should be more kind and tolerant and compassionate and that sort of thing. You know, as if there's, you know, going to be a test at the end, or, you know, some kind of, you're going to be graded on this somehow. And again, Buddhism gives an answer that actually accords very well with neurobiological research. Why should we be loving? Because we'll be happier. You know? That when I act from love, I'm actually aligning with my own deepest nature. And that to live from love consistently, I'm enjoying a kind of fulfillment that I could not get otherwise. And so that there's this actually profound connection between love and happiness. You know, the happier I am, the more I can love. The more I love, the happier I am, you know. You know, the Dalai Lama even says, you know, you want to make other people happy, treat them with compassion. You want to be happy yourself, treat other people with compassion, you know. And really from the, you know, certainly from the Buddhist view, as well as the view really held by energy healers, the deeper reality is that we're all connected. We're all connected as a single fabric, you might say. And that love is something that ultimately aligns me with this deeper texture of interconnection. I'm not sure if that makes any sense. And love in many ways is the highest value, and to that end, it's a kind of extremism. And I think of an extraordinary document. This is a document written by Dr. King called The Letter from a Birmingham Jail. It's really I consider it one of the foundational American documents. And there's a passage where he talks about extremism, and he was doing this work in Birmingham, and he had been arrested and thrown into jail, and among other things, some white clergymen had accused him of extremism. They had used this term, you know, you're an extremist. And he thought about that, and at first he was bothered by it, but then as he thought about it more, he realized that he should embrace something about that term. And so there's this famous passage. Was not Jesus an extremist for love? Love your enemy, bless them that curse you, do good to them that hate you, and pray for them which despitefully use you and persecute you. Was not Amos an extremist for justice? Let justice roll down like water and righteousness, like an ever-flowing stream. Was not Paul an extremist for the Christian gospel? I bear in my body the marks of the Lord Jesus. Was not Martin Luther an extremist? Here I stand, I can do no other, so help me God. And John Bunyan, I will stay in jail to the end of my days before I make a butchery of my conscience. And Abraham Lincoln, this nation cannot survive half slave and half free. And Thomas Jefferson, we hold these truths to be self-evident that all men are created equal. So the question is not whether we will be extremists, but what kind of extremists will we be? Will we be extremists for hate or for love? Will we be extremists for the preservation of injustice or for the extension of justice? And this idea of love being an extreme and being an extremist for love, I mean, certainly we could say, you know, insofar as we're at a meditation group on Monday night in Berkeley, we're certainly on the side of being extremists for love. And that can be a sweet kind of self-congratulatory thing to say. But also part of that is to speak a message of universal love, that is a kind of extremism. And other people will see that as extremism and will be threatened by it, you know. And to hold that, you know, and to hold, you know, and it, you know, of all messages, it's a particularly tricky message because there's all kinds of messages that are extreme and people take the extreme, you know, stance and then they don't care about the people that you know, aren't bothered or, you know, don't like it. To be an extremist for love actually makes us incredibly compassionate for the people who are threatened by that very message, you know? And so there's something very paradoxical there. So I think at this point I'll share the quote sheet. Let's see. So I have the quote from the Gospels, also the quote from the Bodhisattva vow. Just this quote that probably is not a direct quote from the Buddha scripture, but it's kind of a paraphrase. Someone asked the Buddha, what's the biggest mistake we make in life? The Buddha replied, the biggest mistake is you think you have time. You know, and just this kind of urgency of, are we taking the opportunities to love right now? The passage from the letter of Birmingham Jail and a couple other quotes from Dr. King, life's most persistent and urgent question is, what are you doing for others? Another quote from his, it really boils down to this, that all life is interrelated. We are all caught in an inescapable network of mutuality, tied into a single garment of destiny. Whatever affects one destiny affects all indirectly. I think that should be tied, not tired. And then finally, the ultimate measure of a man is not where he stands in moments of comfort and convenience, but where he stands at times of challenge and controversy. And again, you know, it's very easy to be loving when we're comfortable, you know. How loving are we in a moment of challenge? Hafiz said, how did the rose ever open its heart and give to the world all of its beauty? It felt the encouragement of light against its being. Otherwise, we all remain too frightened. Just such a powerful, powerful message. Goethe said quite simply, we are shaped and fashioned by what we love. Rilke reminds us our deepest fears are like dragons guarding our deepest treasures. And sometimes the deepest places of tenderness are the places that have been most deeply wounded. So it's our deepest possibility for love only comes when we can heal those places. A student asked the Zen teacher Soen Nakagawa during a meditation retreat, "I am very discouraged, what should I do?" And Soen brilliantly responded, "Encourage others." You know, and there's such profound wisdom in that. And it speaks to something very profound about us that, you know, if I'm down, if I start to help others, then I feel better about myself. Merton said, "To say that I am in the image of God is to say that love is the reason for my existence, for God is love." You know, and it's a fascinating thing. What does it mean to say love is the reason for my existence? You know, do I live my everyday life as if love is the reason for my existence? An odd one from William Arthur Ward. He said, "Flatter me, I may not believe you. Criticize me, and I may not like you. Ignore me, and I may not forgive you. Encourage me, and I will not forget you. Love me, and I may be forced to love you." And there is this almost magnetic power in love, you know? And it's funny, even some of the people who were most opposed to Dr. King, after his death, they had to admit he was a very loving man. A student asked the master Song Sun, "What is love?" Song Sun said, "I ask you, what is love?" The student was silent. "This is love," Song Sun said. Song Sun said, "You ask me, I ask you, this is love." Wonderful Zen quality in that. Ram Dass said, "The human heart has the extraordinary capacity to hold and transform the sorrows of life into a great stream of compassion. Compassion is the movement of concern and kindness in response to the difficulty of any living being. Compassion arises when you allow your heart to be touched by the pain and need of another." And it is true, all the ways that we have suffered, that opens up the possibility that we can hold compassion both for ourselves and for others who go through those sorts of things, you know. And, you know, at a larger level, you might even say that the reason that there is suffering in this world is so that we can all learn compassion. The Dalai Lama said, "I believe all suffering is caused by ignorance. People inflict pain on others in the selfish pursuit of their happiness or satisfaction. Yet true happiness comes from a sense of inner peace and contentment, which in turn must be achieved through the cultivation of altruism, of love and compassion, and the elimination of ignorance, selfishness, and greed." And then the other Dalai Lama quote I already quoted before. Rachel Naomi Remen said, "When we know ourselves to be connected to all others, acting compassionately is simply the natural thing to do." And so at a certain point in our awakening, in our spiritual development, it becomes just more natural, more spontaneous to be compassionate. John Kabat-Zinn said, "Perhaps ultimately spiritual simply means experiencing wholeness and interconnectedness directly. Seeing that individuality and the totality are interwoven, that nothing is separate or extraneous. So when you see in this way, then everything becomes spiritual in its deepest sense. Doing science is spiritual. So is washing the dishes. It is the inner experience which counts, and you have to be there for it. All else is mere thinking." And so again, that profound teaching about the interconnectedness of all beings. Jack Kornfield said, whatever your difficulties, a devastated heart, a financial loss, feeling assaulted by the conflicts around you, or a seemingly hopeless illness, you can always remember that you are free in every moment to set the compass of your heart to your highest intention. In fact, the two things that you are always free to do, despite your circumstances, are to be present and to be willing to love.